Today's sermon is Thorns in Your Sides, Part 3. The Bible verse is Joshua 23:11-13. You may all stand in honor of the Holy Scriptures. I will read it to you. We've had this verse before. It says in verse 11, Joshua says, now Joshua's getting ready to die. And he says, take good heed unto yourselves that you do what? That you love the Lord your God. Do you love the Lord? Then you have to do this if you love him. Else, if you do it anywise, go back and cleave unto the remnant of these nations, even these that remain among you, and shall make marriages with them, and go in unto them, and they to you. He's talking about who? The Canaanite nations. Do you know any person that's married to a Jew? I do. Know for a certainty that the Lord your God will no more drive out any of these Canaanite nations from before you. The Jews are here. God's not going to drive them out. But they shall be what? Snares and traps unto you. And scourges in your sides and thorns in your eyes until you perish from off this good land which the Lord your God has given you. You may be seated. This verse is kind of a scary verse. It shows that we have enemies. And if we do certain things, God's going to bring a judgment. I don't know how anyone could say that the Canaanites are not these four things to us. A snare, a trap, scourges, and thorns in the eyes. I never got to study World War II in high school, as we always ran out of time. We had spent so much time on all the explorers at the beginning of the semester that there was no time left to study the most recent wars. I think that was a big mistake. I was born approximately 1 year after Japan attacked the United States Navy in Pearl Harbor. Japan and Germany were fighting on the same side. They had made an agreement that if anyone declared war on the other, they had declared war against them. This was against God's law and a huge miscue for Germany. So that is how I learned of how we, the United States, got into the war to fight Germany. But I always had two perplexing questions. Number one, Cincinnati, which is where I was living, as well as the United States, had a large German population. Randa's father's family, for example, immigrated from Prussia. With such a large German population, why would the United States fight against their brothers? Second question. Germany was at the center of the Protestant Reformation. The Soviet Union was a Jewish communist country. Why would the United States fight on the side of our enemy? That's the question Patton asked before he got killed. I was a Baptist at that time, and we had fought many Germans who were Baptists also. It was after the Japanese bombed Pearl Harbor that we declared war against Japan. And when we did this, we automatically was at war with Germany. No wonder it was a false flag. The certain powerful elite in America knew that the Japanese were coming, and they let them arrive, killing many Americans. I wrote a paper on Pearl Harbor when I was at the university, based on the book written by the man who was in charge of the serviceman at the infamous harbor. He was only the rear admiral. He told that when he called the president's office, he could not get a hold of him. He was out playing golf. Within a couple of hours, many Americans were dead, and we were at war. I have lived almost 70 years before I learned that World War II was started 9 years before I was born, in 1933. In my last sermon on this subject, I quoted Rabbi Maurice L. Perswig of the World Jewish Congress, telling a Canadian audience that, quote, "The World Jewish Congress has been at war with Germany for 7 years, unquote. I didn't even know the World Jewish Congress was at war with anybody. The speech was given on February 26, 1940. Let's see, 1940 minus 7 is 1933. And then I gave what I consider a very interesting quote from a rabbi about a month before I was born. 1 month before I was born, he said this. Quote, "The Second World War is being fought for the defense of the fundamentals of Judaism." That's what World War II was fought about. The Jews from all over the world had declared war on Germany in 1933, and the war was being fought for the defense of the fundamentals of Judaism. What did that mean? The war was not fought for freedom from Nazi terrorism. That means that international Jewry formally declared its unholy war against Christian Germany long before Hitler began restricting the rights of Germany's Jews. Jewry's war declaration against Germany was issued by Samuel Untermyer of the World Jewish Federation. If you don't know who Samuel Untermyer is, you need to know who Samuel Untermyer is. He was the head of the Jewish Federation, who said in the New York Times on August 7, 1933, that it would be means of, quote, "economic boycott that will undermine the Hitler regime and bring the German people to their senses by destroying their export trade on which their very existence depends," unquote. They're at war with Germany. The Jews are all over the world. They don't have a separate country at this time. They're not going to buy any German goods. It wasn't long after I learned that the Jews declared war on Germany that Germany did the same thing to the Jews. They advocated a boycott of all Jewish goods. They were boycotting each other's goods. And what happened next? Both parties signed a transfer agreement. But I will leave this alone for now and tell you in this sermon what happened to the Protestant churches of Jesus Christ. What happened to them that now they believe different doctrines and have discarded the true main doctrines that they used to believe? What happened to the Protestant church? The Protestant church is deceived. Imagine my surprise when I read that New York attorney Samuel Untermyer, a leader in the Rothschild movement, and the man who helped finance the Scofield Bible. More about that later. Made a most hateful propaganda speech of unprecedented magnitude against the German people on the New York radio station, August 6, 1933, they declared war against the Christian people of Germany. They were Christian people. Remember, Germany was the center of the what? Protestant Reformation. We were a Protestant nation. Samuel Untermyer helped in financing the Scofield Bible. What? A Jewish lawyer helped put together a Christian reference Bible? If you don't know what this Bible is, be thankful that you haven't read its notes. But it's more likely than not that you do follow its Bible notes. Why? Because almost every seminary uses this reference Bible. It has changed the American churches into being very pro-Israel, or that means pro-Jewish. I used to belong to several independent Baptist churches. That's in the late 60s and 70s. That said that we, meaning the local church, follow the Scofield Bible. All church members should get a Scofield Bible and read it. So I bought my first Scofield Bible. I didn't even know who Scofield was. I read its notes, and it kept me in the dark until I learned Christian identity. What do the Scofield Bible and Samuel Untermyer have to do with World War I and World War II? Without them, the United States would probably not have gotten involved with fighting either World War. Cyrus Scofield and the Secret Six. If you haven't heard of who the Secret Six is, you can study all the American history you want in school. They won't tell you who the Secret Six is. Cyrus Scofield was a young con artist who lived in Kansas after the Civil War. It was at this time that Cyrus met up with John J. Ingalls, an aging Jewish lawyer who had been sent to Kansas by the Secret Six some 30 years before to work on the abolitionist case. Who were the Secret Six? It's been close to 20 years ago when I first came upon this group in my studies. It was when I discovered, this shocked me to death, and it shocked the members of the church, when I told them the heresy of the popular church hymn, the battle hymn of the Republic. Most church members, including myself in the past, sing this very popular song and feel very patriotic. Without knowing what this song means and why it was written or anything about its author, whose name was Julia Howe. Julia Howe was the wife of one of the Secret Six. She was a Unitarian and did not believe in the deity of Jesus Christ. Is he a Christian? The fact is, the song was not written to praise God or Jesus. Julia Howe was a social activist and an ardent abolitionist. Together with her husband, Dr. Samuel Gridley Howe, he's the first of the Secret Six, who edited the Boston Commonwealth, a prominent anti-slavery paper, to which he also contributed articles, essays, and poems. The story is this. In November of 1861, Samuel and Julia Howe were invited to Washington, D.C. by President Lincoln, where they toured a number of Union Army camps along the Potomac River. While visiting these camps, they heard the soldiers singing a song that was well known in both the North and the South. It was a tune written by a Southerner named John W. Stafe in 1855 entitled John Brown's Body. If you don't know who John Brown is, you didn't study American history very well. John Brown, of course, is a radical abolitionist who Mrs. Howe admired and who had been hung for his raid on the Harper's Ferry Arsenal in 1859. In an attempt to secure weapons to arm slaves in Virginia for a revolt. I gave a sermon about this. I said the first person he shot and killed was a black man. and he let him die right there, bleed to death. Reverend James Freeman Clark, a Unitarian, another false Christian minister, and fellow abolitionist, was also on the tour. Being familiar with Mrs. Howe's poems, he urged her to write a new song fitting that tune for the war effort to replace John Brown's body. Well, she did so that very night. Staying at the Willard Hotel in Washington on the night of November 18, 1861, Mrs. Howe awoke from her sleep with the words of the song in her mind, and in near darkness wrote down the verses. So the middle of the night, she gets up, all the verses in her mind, she writes them down. She called the result the Battle Hymn of the Republic. Some even say the words were given to her by demonic forces, the same way many songs are given to the songwriters today. And this was the only song my mother could play on the piano. But this song is not about the return of Jesus Christ, as my mother and millions of Christians believed. For Mrs. Howe did not believe in that. But it was written to inspire the Union soldiers who were facing death in their effort to prosecute Lincoln's war of aggression against the Southern Confederacy. Why any Southerner sings this song, I don't know. It is the Union soldiers that are in the glory in this hymn. So, as they are described to defeat the nasty Southern soldiers by their ability to, quote, crush the serpent with his heel, unquote. The song says the Northern army is to crush the Southern army. The allegory is the North is the Lord and the South is the serpent. Why would any Christian sing this song once you understand what the words really mean? Besides physician Samuel Gridley Howe, there were five other members. Theodore Parker, a Unitarian preacher. George Luther Stearns, a manufacturer. Franklin B. Sanborn, a teacher. Garrett Smith, who was a multimillionaire. And Reverend Thomas Wentworth Higgins, a Unitarian preacher, literary critic, and social activist. All six of these men were really contemptible men who, number one, hired an assassin, two, armed a murderer, three, supported secret crime in the name of compassion, and four, dealt their country a terrible blow while claiming the motives of angels. Sounds like many in Congress, the Supreme Court, or even the executive branch of the government of the United States today. Is the same way our government functions today. Who runs our government? Secret Jews run our government. I'm going to show you the secret six. The first one is Dr. Samuel Gridley Howe. He was a Boston physician. Samuel Howe joined his wife, Julia Ward Howe, who was famous for her Battle Hymn of the Republic, and championing social reforms from better treatment for the disabled to the abolition of slavery. Howe disapproved of Brown's raid of Missouri slave farms, and he had only a mild enthusiasm for his Harper's Ferry venture. After Brown was arrested at Harper's Ferry, Howe published a disclaimer and fled the country. Now, Brown and the Missouri slave farms, he shot innocent people. I told you that sermon I got 20 years ago. At night, he rounded up families, took the father out, shot him, took the son out, shot him. These people had no slaves, didn't know anything about slaves, they cared nothing about slaves. He just murdered them. He's the original terrorist. Thomas Wentworth Higginson, a Worcester, Massachusetts Unitarian minister and devout transcendentalist, was an anti-slavery disunionist and among Brown's strongest backers. Higginson wrote Brown, "I have perfect confidence in you. All you do will be well done," unquote. Look at these people. Higginson counted among his best friends. Anybody read Henry David Thoreau in high school? You ever read his writings? And Amos Alcott, the father of Louisa May. Anybody read a book by Louisa May Alcott? He has been described by historian David Reynolds in his book, John Brown's Abolitionist, as being what? The most radical member of the Secret Six, urging Brown to launch the Virginia Plan early and publicly announcing his support of Brown after the raid failed. When he learned that the other members of the Secret Six were abandoning Brown after his arrest, Higginson wrote Sandburg, "Is there no such thing as honor among Confederates?" One historian described Higginson as perhaps the most radical man in America during the Civil War era. The third one, Theodore Parker, liberal transcendentalist Boston minister Theodore Parker, was a strong supporter of slave revolts in favor of women rights. Women couldn't vote, you know, at this time. Temperance and prison reform. His radicalism, fueled by enactment of the Fugitive Slave Act, Parker participated in attempts and rescues of fugitive slaves and formed a vigilant committee in Boston to fight these seeking to capture fugitive slaves. Parker wrote at the time of the Harper's Ferry attack, "One held against his will as a slave has a natural right to kill everyone who seeks to prevent his enjoyment of liberty." He needs to read the Bible. There's a story of a slave in the New Testament. Franklin Sanborn, Concord resident and Harvard-educated intellectual Franklin Sanborn, served as the secretary of the Massachusetts State Kansas Committee and ran a school. It so happens that Ralph Waldo Emerson's, oh, we read his books too, didn't we? Were among his students while only in his mid-20s. Sandburg first provided money, arms, books for Brown's activities in Kansas and later at Harper's Ferry. Sandburg, who saw Brown as an unmixed Puritan breed, introduced him to two other members of the Secret Six, Parker and Higginson. He also arranged for Brown to make a plea for financial support directly to the Massachusetts legislature. But a bill to aid the Kansas anti-slavery efforts failed. In 1885, Sandburg published The Life and Letters of John Brown. Gerrit Smith, multimillionaire, anti-slavery philanthropist of Peterborough, New York, was the first member of the Secret Six. Secret. You didn't know about him. Secret. To meet Brown. Smith, the only member of the Six not to share transcendentalist leanings, facilitated between supporting peaceful non-resistance to slavery and Brown-style militants. In 1859, he provided $700. In 1859, $700 is a lot of money, to aid Brown's plans after Brown's successful slave raid in Missouri. Smith said, quote, "I was once doubtful in my own mind as to Captain Brown's course. I now approve of it heartily," unquote. Following Brown's arrest at Harper's Ferry, Smith destroyed his documents that could link him to Brown. He became so fearful that his connection to Brown would be exposed that he spent time in a lunatic asylum. That's where he belongs, in a lunatic asylum. George Luther Stearns, like Martin Luther King. When president of the Massachusetts Kansas Committee, George Stearns met Brown in the office of his Boston factory. The two took to each other like the iron and the magnet, according to Stearns' son. Brown's autobiographical letter to Stearns' 12-year-old son Henry makes for compelling reading. Stearns became the chief contributor of both funds and arms to Brown. Following Brown's capture, Stearns fled to Canada, where he made it to Brown's execution. Stern said, I consider it the proudest act of my life, the proudest thing I've ever done, that I gave good old John Brown every pike and rifle he carried to Harper's Ferry. During the Civil War, Stearns led the effort to recruit black soldiers for the Union Army. On January 1st, 1863, Stearns hosted the John Brown Party to celebrate the Emancipation Proclamation issued that afternoon by President Lincoln. He later helped establish the Freedmen's Bureau that played a major role in the fight to win freed slaves the right to vote. That's quite a Secret Six, if you ask me. That's just a little touch of it. The Secret Six were not Christians, although some of them were preachers and members of the false Unitarian Church. They had sent a Jewish lawyer to Kansas to aid in the cause of abolition. Schofield meets up with this Jewish lawyer, who pulls some strings, which assists Schofield in gaining admission to the bar, and procured his appointment as federal attorney for Kansas. The Jewish lawyer, Ingalls, and Schofield became partners in a railroad scam, which led to Cyrus serving time for criminal forgery. So the Secret Six is indirectly involved with the Schofield Bible. Tell you a little bit about Cyrus Schofield's life. While he was in prison, Schofield began studying the philosophy of who? John Darby, pioneer of the Plymouth Brother movement, and his now famous Any Moment Now rapture doctrine. That's where it came from. He meets some preachers who are of the same new persuasion. Cyrus is invited to hold pastorates, which he did. Upon his release from prison, Schofield deserted his first wife, Leontine Carey Schofield, and his two daughters, Abigail and Helen. He deserted them, gave them nothing. He took as his mistress a young girl from St. Louis Flower Mission, so he's got a mistress. He later abandoned her for Helen Van Ward, who eventually married. This man's disqualified from being a pastor. Cyrus was preaching John Darby's doctrine of the postponed kingdom, in which a Jewish kingdom would rule the world. He had adopted Darby's idea that Christ would rule from the old Jerusalem in a Jewish setting, and hence they believed it necessary for the Jews to establish a Jewish state in Palestine. Did anyone in their past believe any of this? Well, I did. The church I belonged to had a Schofield Bible. We used Schofield's Bible notes. We believed this very strongly. And this caught the attention of certain powerful who? Jews. And so Schofield was contacted by Samuel Untermeyer, a prominent Jewish lawyer, who was one of the framers of the Federal Reserve Act, and a briber of President Wilson to get a Jewish man picked to go to the Supreme Court, that was Justice Brandeis, and for the United States to fight in World War I. I would not have got this in my study of U.S. history in high school. It's true. It's what happened. Following his Illuminati connections to New York, he settled at the Lotus Club, which he listed as his residence for the next 20 years. It was here that he presented his ideas for a new Christian reference Bible and was taken under the wing of Samuel Untermeyer. See, Samuel Untermeyer comes up every place in American history, who later became chairman of the American Jewish Committee, president of the American League of Jewish Patriots, and chairman of the non-sectarian anti-Nazi League. Oh, a snare, a trap, a scourge, and a thorn was being placed in the body of the Israelites. They had failed to heed the warnings given them by their God. They should have not allowed any Canaanite to be in their country like many of their fathers had done in Europe. Both Germany and the United States are guilty. Untermyer introduced Schofield to numerous Zionist and socialist leaders, including Samuel Gompers, Ferrolio LaGuardia, Abraham Strauss, Bernard Barak, he's another famous one, and Jacob Schiff, Federal Reserve System. These were people who financed Schofield's research trips to Oxford, England, and arranged the publication and distribution of his concordance. I was interested in LaGuardia. Why? LaGuardia Airport. It's located in New York City, LaGuardia. It's named for the former mayor of New York City who helped finance Cyrus Schofield's trips to England. It's a Jew. A man who is not even qualified to be a preacher. He abandoned his first wife and his two daughters. He has a mistress. He gets put in jail for fraudulent activities. He got involved with Dwight L. Moody, another preacher. Then he gets involved with a large number of Jews. It is impossible to overstate the influence of Cyrus Schofield on 20th century Christian beliefs. It's impossible to overstate the influence of this Bible. The Schofield Bible is the standard reference work in virtually all Christian ministries and divinity schools. It is singularly responsible for the Christians' mistaken belief that the Hebrew prophecies describing the kingdom of Jesus' second coming, and not in fact the Zionist vision of a man-made new world order. It is precisely because Christians persist in this belief that they remain blind to the reality of Zion. Schofield served as the agent. That's what these people are. They're agents. It's like Obama doesn't decide anything. He's an agent. Hillary won't decide anything. She's picked. They picked the presidents. Schofield served as the agent by which the Zionist paralyzed what? Christianity, while they prepared America for the Jews' final conquest. I'm going to show you a little bit about the Schofield Bible. I can't show you a whole bunch. It's very easy to disprove. The first one was 1908. The next is 1967. I got both Bibles. But I'm going to talk first about Martin Luther. Martin Luther taught a person had to be chosen by God in order to be saved. Lutherans teach the exact opposite. Man chooses God. Martin Luther taught that the Jews were the enemy of Christians and their God. Luther's invite them to speak to their churches about the Seder and the Old Testament. One wonders why a Lutheran today is called a Lutheran, because he believes so little what Martin Luther believed. Now, the following is taken from an article written by Ed Somerville. I took it straight from his article. Quote, "As regarding the Jews, Luther's view of them was not too different than the average person today. Although he, referring to Luther, was aware of their cursed usury, which was prohibited by the church, and also their pursuit of lowering the morals of the youth." Think they lower the morals of the youth? Look at the bathing suits from 1900 to now. "He still regarded them with reservations as God's chosen people, as the people, including Christians, do today. Most, Most Christians believe the Jews are God's chosen people. I did. I used the Scofield Bible. He then decided to read what? Their Talmud. Anybody who reads the Talmud would have their mind changed. So as to find out what motivated them to be the people they were. That's a good idea. I doubt if he took his time to read all the volumes it contained, because there's many volumes. But he read enough to find that it was the most disgusting, hateful, and immoral thing that he had ever read. Now, this is Ed Somerville writing, this is not me. I agree with what he says. After reading it, he wrote the book, The Jews and Their Lies, which you will not find in any Christian bookstore today. Recently, the Zionists put enough pressure on the Lutheran Church that they agreed to say that Luther was senile when he wrote The Jews and Their Lies, which, if read by the Lutherans as well as all Christians, would be unbelievable or questionable. Unquote. I believe that is certainly true. But it is all in the plans of the Jews in destroying Christianity's true doctrine. They did the same thing with the Scofield Bible notes. Remember, these notes are used in almost every seminary in the world today. I'll give you some examples. The first one is Genesis 12:3. I spoke on this before, but it's so important I'm going to speak on it again. And I will bless them that bless thee, referring to Abram, and curse him that curses thee, also speaking to Abram. And in thee shall all families of the earth be blessed. I'm going to read you what the Scofield 1967 notes say. Quote, there was a promise of blessing upon these individuals and nations who bless Abram's descendants, and a curse laid upon those who persecute the blank. The word that's missing in the blank space is the word Jews. Scofield later adds, this was a warning literally fulfilled in the history of Israel's persecutions. It has invariably fared ill with the people who have persecuted the Jew, well with those who have protected him. Then he says, look at this, for a nation to commit the sin of anti-Semitism brings inevitable judgment. Well, Scofield didn't write that, because this is not in the 1908 version. He had been dead. And does that fit the last century, the United States of America, the new melting pot of the world, since America began to protect Hasidic, Ashkenazi, and Sephardic Jews? They're hopelessly in debt. They have not won any war. They have embraced homosexuality. They soon will make same-sex marriages legal nationally. They are hooked on rock and roll. They are being seduced by sorcery. Their government is full of criminals. They're overrun with illegal immigrants. They are consumed with businesses that advocate games of chance. They are flooded with amusement games and activities. Their churches are so bad that they have thrown away most of their true doctrine, that they're nothing more than Baal churches. Maybe its young people are tattooed, punctured with all kinds of pins, and dressed in modesty. When I was at the beach or at the shopping center, I see these people said, my goodness, who are these people? Is the United States doing well in protecting the Jew? And does Scofield, whoever wrote this nonsense, know what a Semite is? Now I've got a chart. A Semite is a descendant of Shem, one of the three sons of Noah. Ham and Japheth are his other two sons. In the chart, all people, and I made yellow highlight in my article, it's Shem, Abraham, Ishmael, Isaac, Esau, and Jacob. They're all Semites. Arabs, descendants of Ishmael, are Semites. Arabs are Semites. True covenant Christians, pure descendants of Jacob, are Semites. Ashkenazis are of Japheth. Are they Semites? The Jews are the worst offender of what they accuse others of. They have murdered millions of Semites, Arabs and Christians. So the Scofield Bible condemns the Jews when it tries to bless them. Now there's more Scofield lies. I'm going to mention this one. There are more other lies that are taught in Scofield's notes. For example, some Scofield's notes have been altered or removed by the Oxford University after his death. Oxford University owns the copyright to the Bible. Oxford University in England is a very leftist organization. The university owns the copyright. Get Scofield Bible and look at this at Oxford University. The 1967 note says, "The contrast, I know that you are Abraham's seed. And if you were Abraham's children, is that between the natural and the spiritual posterity of Abraham? The Israelitish and Ishmaelitish people are the former, and all who were of the precious faith with Abraham, whether Jew or Gentiles, are the latter." That's referring to John 8:39. Now we compare this with the 1967 edition. Quote, John 8:37, "All Jews are natural descendants of Abraham, but are not necessarily his spiritual posterity," unquote. They left out Ishmaelish people. Oh. And how can all Jews be natural descendants of Abraham? Persons of all races are Jews, and new Jews are to be converted every day from every race. They are Hasidic, Sephardic, and Ashkenazi Jews. Only about 7% of all Jews today are descendants of Abraham. The vast majority of Jews are natural descendants of Canaan. Cursed Canaan, not Abraham. Scofield adds in his notes on Romans 9:6 that, quote, "The New Testament indicates," get this, "the New Testament indicates no distinction between the terms Jew, Israelite, and Hebrew." How many Christians do you know that says that's true? Of course, he has no note on 2 Kings 16:6. The very first verse, the word Jew is in the King James Version, in which what? Israel is fighting the Jew. I don't know how much more distinction you get between that. They're fighting each other. In fact, you'll find no notes or a very short note on scriptures such as John 8:44. Ephesians 2:11-22, it's used all the time. Hosea chapter 1, and Jeremiah 3:8, and so forth. There are a few examples of Zionist perversion of scriptures that have shaped the doctrine of America's most politically powerful religious subculture. The Christian Zionist, as Ariel Sharon calls them, or the dispensationalists, as intellectual followers call themselves, or the Judeo-Christians, as our politically correct politicians describe themselves. Today's Mideast wars are not caused by the predisposition of these peoples, who are no more warlike than any human tribes. Without the pandering to Jewish and Zionist interests that is carried out by this subculture, the most vocal being the celebrity Christian evangelist, there would be no such wars. For there's not enough support for war outside of organized Zionist Christianity. Isn't that true today? Christian Zionism may be the most bloodthirsty apostasy in the entire history of Christianity or of any other religion. Shame on its leaders. They have already brought the blood of untold numbers of innocent people down upon the spires and prayer benches of America's churches. My conclusion. Let's look at one more Scofield's notes. Genesis 10:2. The sons of Japheth, Gomer, and Magog, and Madai, Javan, and Tubal, Meshech, and Tyrus. Here's Schofield's note. From these seven sons of Japheth are descended the Goyim, or Gentile, translated our nations, translated heathen, 148 times in the AV. The name implies nothing concerning religion, meaning simply non-Israelite or foreigner. In addition to this note we read on the previous page, the former note regarding Japheth's son Gomer, Schofield's note. Progenitor of the ancient Cerimians and Cimmeri, from whom are descended the Celtic family. You believe that, Jim? Just read Jim's book and you'll see how wrong that is. This view set in stone the idea that the Jews were Israel and that the Jewish state was the fulfillment of Bible prophecy of the regathering of the ancient house of Israel. Biblical history shows the Israelites to be the 10 tribes of the northern house of Israel who were deported to Assyria and then lost. But Schofield wrongly identified the Jews as Israelites. The Celts are also misidentified as being non-Israelites or heathen people. That's some of us. Further, the Bible speaks prophetically of the house of Israel by the name of Gomer. In the book of Hosea, oh, that book's a great book. You won't hear it being preached in most Judeo-Christian churches. The prophet representing Christ had married a harlot by the name of Gomer, representing the house of Israel. Gomri or Gimri was what the Assyrians called Israel. The name was actually derived from King Omri, 1 Kings 16:23 through 28, which at that time was pronounced Gomri. Hence the Gomri or Gimri were the Israelites that had been deported to Assyria near the Caspian Sea. Assyrian records of this Israelites were unearthed in the excavation of Nineveh in the year 1900. And published fully in 1930 by the University of Michigan Press. The problem was there are two Gomers in the Bible. The one, of course, was the wife of Hosea, who prophetically represented the Israelites in captivity. The other was the son of Japheth, mentioned in Genesis 10:2. A lot of people have Dr. Bullinger's Bible. I do. It's called the Companion Bible. He's another dispensationalist from the Schofield era who wrote virtually the same thing in his Bible. He said, Gomer, an Assyrian Gimri, the Kimmerans of Herodias, progenitor of the Celts. Both of them mixed up the two Gomers. The Gimri, or Celts, were descended from the Israelites that the Assyrians called Gomri, Humri, or Gimri, named for King Omri of Israel. But both Schofield and Bullinger identified the Celts with the earlier Gomer, who was the son of Japheth. Merrill Unger's book, Archaeology and the Old Testament, clears up this misconception. It says, quote, the initial contact between Israel and Assyria eventually occurred during Omri's day, King Omri. And from that time on, Israel appears in cuneiform records as Bet-Humri, the house of Omri. This mix-up laid the foundations for the Christian support of the Jewish state. But there's something else. It further confuses the issue. We realize that in Genesis 10:3, we learn that one of Gomer's sons' name is Ashkenaz, who is the father of the Russian Eastern European Jews. Today, the descendants called the Ashkenazim account for approximately 93% of all Jews living today. So Scofield calls what? Evil good and good evil. Scofield tells with his notes what his notes are going to teach. For in his introduction, page VI, 1908 edition, he says, the biblical story of Israel, past, present, and future, falls into seven distinct periods. Period one, from the call of Abram to the Exodus. Well, this is what the Bible starts off with, right? Two, from the Exodus to the death of Joshua. Three, from the death of Josiah to the establishment of Hebrew monarchy under King Saul. The fourth period, from the period of the kings from Saul to the captivities. The fifth, the period of the captivities. Sixth, the restored commonwealth from the end of the Babylonian captivity of Judah to the destruction of Jerusalem, A.D. 70. And the seventh is the present dispersion. What's missing from these seven dispensations? Would you put these in the seven dispensations of the Old Testament? What's missing? Is your marriage an important event of your life? The marriage of God to Israel, the split of the kingdom into the house of Israel and the house of Judah, and the divorce of the house of Israel are very important events which are required for the understanding of the Bible. Scofield does acknowledge who Israel was in the book of Hosea. It says, quote, his note, Israel in Hosea means the 10 tribes forming the northern kingdom as distinguished from Judah, the tribes of Judah and Benjamin, forming the southern kingdom which adhered to the Davidic family. Did he say there was no distinction between Israel, Jews, and Hebrews? Contradicts himself. In Hosea chapter 2, Scofield said that Israel is the wife of Jehovah. Now disowned, but yet to be restored, is the clear teaching of the passages. But he failed to give it a major consideration. For it is these people, the lost 10 tribes of Israel, which were divorced by God, are who Jesus Christ still loved, even though they were kicked out of his covenant for a while. They were the ones that were once married to God. They are the ones called Gentiles in the Bible, with few exceptions. He should have had this note in Ephesians chapter 2. And lastly, Scofield also says in his introduction the following. I'm quoting right from the Scofield's notes. The Acts of the Apostles record the descent of the Holy Spirit and the beginning of a new thing in human history, the church. The division of the race now becomes threefold, the Jew, the Gentile, and the church of God. Just as Israel is in the foreground from the call of Abraham to the resurrection of Christ, so now the church fills the scene from the second chapter of the book of Acts to the fourth chapter of Revelation. That's all the church. I can't tell you how many times I heard this when I was in the Independent Baptist Church. This is where they got it from. Acts 2 to Revelation 4, Church of God. Beginning after Acts 4, goes back to the Jews. The remaining chapters of that book complete the story of humanity and the final triumph of Christ. To summarize, Scofield taught that the scriptures tell us about the Jews from Genesis 11 to Acts 1. The Gentiles, Church of God, Acts 2 to Revelation 4, and the Jews from Revelation 5 to Revelation 22. The Jews are the covenant people of God, Scofield said, and also that the Gentile church is now in effect. Gentile church? Well, depends on your being a Gentile, isn't it? Then they'll be raptured away, and he deals with the Jews once again. How many Christians believe that? That's what I believed. It came from the Scofield Bible that was written by Jews. Cyrus says that since the Jews rejected Jesus Christ, they are put in a parenthesis until the church is taken away. May God have mercy on our souls. To be continued, blessed be the Lord God of Israel.